Today at Reader's Corner, Patrick Radin Keefe, author of Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The Troubles in Northern Ireland had deep roots. For most of the 20th century, Northern Ireland was marked by discrimination and hostility between a majority of its population, dubbed the Unionists, who wanted to remain with the United Kingdom, and a significant minority, mostly Catholics, who were nationalists and wanted a united Ireland independent of British rule. From award-winning New Yorker staff writer Patrick Radin Keefe, Say Nothing is a masterful narrative of the Troubles, winning a Best Book of 2019 by the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Economist, Washington Post, and too many other publications and awards to mention. Patrick Radin Keefe is a storyteller who captures the complexities of a historical moment by digging deeply into the lives of people on all sides of the conflict. He joins us today to talk about his award-winning book, launching in paperback. Patrick Keefe, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks, Bob. Great to be with you.
Patrick, could we start by your just touching on two events that seem to set the stage for the Troubles, the Easter Uprising of 1916 and the Irish War of Independence?
Yeah, absolutely. So the British, the English, had been in Ireland going back hundreds of years. And one of the tricky things about the Troubles as a subject is trying to figure out, you know, where did this thing begin?
Right.
Because there had been an English presence on the island of Ireland for hundreds of years. And ultimately, you get the kind of total English dominion over Ireland. And the Easter Rising was a kind of a botched rebellion in 1916 in which a group of rebels tried to overthrow the English, and the rebellion was quashed. And so what you had was essentially these people who were martyred in that effort. And shortly thereafter, you had the Irish War for Independence, which was a war in which the English were eventually thrown out of most of the island of Ireland. So, you know, when we talk about Ireland today, what we mean is the Republic of Ireland, which is most of the island. It's 26 counties. But after that war, there was the partition of Ireland, and there were six counties left over which remained part of the United Kingdom. And that's the situation even today, that you have Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and then Northern Ireland, which is those six counties in the north. And that's really what my book was about.
Mm-hmm. And you refer to your book a couple of times as covering a three-decade conflict. What would that time frame be?
So what happened is after the War for Independence and partition, you had the situation in which you have this little statelet in the north, and there were many people, particularly Catholics in the north, who wanted Ireland to reunify. They wanted to throw the British out. There was a great deal of discrimination against Catholics in the north. They were a minority in the north and had trouble getting good jobs, good housing, didn't really have much political power. And so for decades, what happened was Catholics, you know, mostly left and came to places like the United States or Australia or England, other places. And the Irish Republican Army, these Irish Republicans who wanted to get the British out, had kind of waxed and waned over the years. You know, there were different periods of time when the effort was more aggressive and less aggressive. But in the late 1960s, you get the advent of what we call the Troubles, which was a period of time in which the IRA and other groups were fighting over this question of what's the identity of these six counties in the north? Are they going to be part of the United Kingdom or part of Ireland? And you had the IRA and other Republican groups, which were paramilitary groups. You had loyalist paramilitary groups, so groups that were loyal to the British crown. You had the police and then also the British Army, which came in. And that became a long festering conflict. They never called it a war, but it basically was an undeclared war for three decades, from the late 1960s to the late 1990s.
You have a quote at the outset of your book that is very telling once the reader gets into the full story. It's, "All wars are fought twice, the first time on the battlefield, the second time in memory." How'd that play out for you as an author as you delved into the Troubles?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, the way I came to this subject was there was an obituary that I read in 2013 of a woman named Dolores Price, and she had been a member of the IRA. And she had joined really right out of her teens, and in the early 1970s had been involved in a lot of very violent activity trying to get the British out of Ireland. And what struck me in the obituary was it talked about the early years of her life when she was this kind of impetuous rebel, doing a lot of terrible things in the name of a cause that she believed was a just cause. But then it talked about how later in her life she looked back and she was kind of reevaluating the things she'd done as a young woman. And there was this sense that a lot of people in Northern Ireland, when they looked back at the worst years of the Troubles, were kind of fighting over what those years meant, what the bloodshed meant. You know, was it worth it? How do you make sense of it? And that was very striking to me, the idea that you could look at a society that had been through a really brutal period of hostility and was trying to make sense of it in the aftermath. And that's at the kind of broad societal level, but also for individuals, you know, that you have people who, in the fervor of youth, in a shooting war, in a conflict, they feel very certain of what they're doing. And part of what I wondered was, well, what if you check in with that person 10 years later, 20 years later, when the conflict is over, they've gotten out of prison, they've gotten married, they've had children of their own. How do they look back and assess the morality of the things they did in their youth?
You know, you mentioned you read this in the obituaries. I have to take you to a place. I normally don't listen or watch any interviews of authors that I'm going to talk to, but my wife sent me one knowing that my mother's name was Shaughnessy and that I grew up in an Irish household. There was that moment when you explained what you were doing reading the obituaries. I think it was about your dad. You might want to relate that story, what he called them, because that's the way it was in my household as well.
Oh, is that right? Yeah, it's funny. My day job is I'm a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, and I'm always looking for subjects that would make interesting articles. And one of the places I often look is the obituary pages. And you know, I think obituaries are fascinating, right? Because often it's a person you've never heard of, and you sort of see a life. You can kind of crack open a whole life you never knew about. And it can be a way into a world that you might never have known much about or imagined. And my father, when I was growing up, he used to love the obituary page. And it's actually, to this day, it's like the first section of the paper that he reads. And the joke in my house is he calls it the Irish sports pages. But it's he picks it up every morning, and that's how he starts the day. He's reading about all the folks who've recently died.
Yeah. You know, the key word memory in your subtitle, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland, I remember growing up with a grandfather. I was very small, and my mother related to me more than perhaps I remembered it. But whenever he would run across or someone would call to his attention an Irishman who was from the north, this is a guy living in St. Louis, Missouri at the time, he would refer to him as the blank Orangeman.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, here's a guy who's in the United States of America. He's settled in. He's now an Irish American, but he still remembers the difference between an Orangeman, a Protestant Northern Irelander, and of course, a Catholic in the same country.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's part of what was really fascinating for me as an outsider. You know, I'm an Irish American, but I'm American. My family came over, over a century ago. So somebody without close ties to Ireland was just the degree to which the memory of stuff that's happened in the past, you know, sometimes 10, 20 years in the past, sometimes hundreds of years ago, is so vivid and fresh, and there's a sense of grievance today in Ireland. So it was interesting for me because I was writing about a murder that happened in 1972, which is before I was born. And yet there was this sense that, you know, it wasn't like writing a history book. There wasn't a sense that that this was some sepia-toned historical artifact. When I went back and forth to Belfast in Northern Ireland, the memory of this, of the conflict and what it meant and of this murder in particular, was just still very raw and fresh. And there was a real sense that that you weren't really talking about the past, you know, that the present is the past over there.
You're listening to Patrick Radin Keefe. He is the author of Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. So give us a sense of this war, if we can call it that. Let's understand the combatants. How many British troops were there at their highest levels? And do we know, can we count the IRA active combatants at the time?
Oh, it's very hard. I mean, gosh, I don't actually have the figure on British troops in front of me right now, but it was thousands. I mean, it was a big, it was a big deployment for the British Army. And what's fascinating is if you talk to veterans of the British Army, they feel often quite bitter because it was never declared a war. And so for generations of British soldiers, Northern Ireland was a place that you deployed, and it was quite dangerous to be deployed there. But there was a sense that unlike, you know, the Falklands or Afghanistan, there's no monument, there's no parade. You know, it wasn't recognized as a war in quite the same way. So you had thousands of British soldiers. You had a very extensive police apparatus in Northern Ireland. So these were, you know, there were British police in Northern Ireland, the Royal Ulster Constabulary. And then you had the IRA, and again, very difficult to get a firm grasp on the numbers because it's a paramilitary group and, you know, people were in and people were out. But certainly hundreds and hundreds of members of the IRA during this period of time. And then a whole series of loyalist terrorist groups were involved as well. So it was really a kind of a multi-vector, very, very dangerous conflict in which a great many civilians end up getting killed and injured.
You open up your book with a riveting account of Jean McConville, her disappearance. Could you just give our listeners a little bit of a teaser on, we don't have to tell the whole story here because I think your book reads like a novel. And as I was reading it, I said to myself what I often say when I read novels and interview authors of novels, I don't want to give everything away because I think readers deserve the right to get this in their own way. But maybe you can at least tell us about the disappearance.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I should say I'm glad to hear you say that about it reading like a novel, because part of what I wanted to do was write something that wouldn't read like a history book. It wouldn't read like a history of the Troubles. It would be more a story about characters. I mean, they were real people, of course, and I, you know, I did a lot of research and went back and forth to Northern Ireland 7 times and wanted to get all the facts exactly right. But my hope was that for people who don't know a lot about this history and who might not pick up a history book about the Troubles, that they could find their way into this story, and it would kind of invite them in by following these people. Jean McConville was a woman who lived in Belfast. She was a mother of 10, and she was a widow. Her husband died in early 1972 of cancer. And they had come from what was called there a mixed marriage, in that she was a Protestant and her husband was Catholic. And they lived in Catholic West Belfast, which is a very Catholic area. And she was raising these 10 kids and very kind of traumatized and demoralized by the fact that war is breaking out around her. She's lost her husband. She's trying to care for these children. And one night in December 1972, there was a knock at the door, and a gang of intruders came in. They were masked. They had guns. And they dragged Jean McConville out of the apartment. And they told her kids, you know, we'll bring her back. We just want to talk to her for a few hours. And they took her out. They took her away. And the children never saw their mother again. And what I just described for you is the first scene of the book. And it's kind of a murder mystery because there's this woman who just vanishes in 1972. And those kids grow up not knowing what happened to their mother. For a long time, they thought she might come back. They were hoping she would come back. But the kids were eventually split up and sent off to different orphanages. And I mentioned earlier the Dolores Price, the obituary that I read that got me into this story in the first place. One of the things that really jumped out at me in that obituary was it mentioned this woman, Dolores Price, who'd been in the IRA, and it suggested that she might have had something to do with the disappearance of Jean McConville. And so part of what I was trying to do in the book was I thought, what if you told a story about the lives of these two very different women who are connected through this act of violence, and one of them is a victim and one of them is a perpetrator, and you use that as a lens to tell the broader story of the Troubles. And so that was the idea with the book.
Now, Jean McConville is only one of many, and I'll let you tell me what many means, of what you refer to in a number of places in the book as the disappeared. Help our listeners understand what's going on there.
Yeah, so there were, over the course of the Troubles, just a little over a dozen people who were not just murdered, but were disappeared. And this is something your listeners might be familiar with from other conflicts. I mean, certainly in Argentina and Chile and Spain, in Cambodia, there have been instances in wartime in which someone is not just killed, but they're buried in a secret grave. And what's really especially pernicious about killing somebody in this manner is that you leave their families with this uncertainty about what happened to them. They don't know whether they're alive or dead. If they're dead, they don't know where they were buried. And, you know, there's no body that you can bury. There's no grave that you can visit. It makes it difficult to mourn. In the Catholic faith, the fact that there's no opportunity to bury the loved one in consecrated ground and come and be able to pray is particularly upsetting. And so this is what happened with Jean McConville, is that what we learn is she was taken away by the IRA. And you might wonder, why would the IRA take away a widowed mother of 10? What would the sense of killing her be? And the answer is that they believed that she was an informant for the British. They believed that she was, Jean McConville was giving information to the British Army. So for this reason, they took her away and they killed her. But they had a sense that it wasn't a great look to be killing a woman and a widowed mother of 10. You know, with one squeeze of the trigger, you orphan 10 kids. And so rather than do what they often did, which is just leave the body out on the street, they made a decision to bury her in a secret grave and not allow anybody to know what had happened. And this is a kind of particularly cruel way to end somebody's life. And I think it created a huge amount of additional trauma, as you can imagine, for her children, her 10 children.
You know, I'm thinking about your comment about the disappeared and how it leaves families without closure. That certainly must have exacerbated the memory side of this entire cycle, this entire period, where it's even more difficult to forget or to forgive when, in fact, there hasn't been that closure, I suppose, wouldn't you think?
Absolutely. And I think that's a big part of the difficulty with the Troubles in particular. So my book is called Say Nothing, and that line comes from a poem by Seamus Heaney, the great Nobel laureate and poet from Northern Ireland, who kind of came of age against the backdrop of the Troubles and wrote this poem actually about the Troubles. And the poem was called Whatever You Say, Say Nothing. And the suggestion was that there was a kind of a culture of silence around the Troubles. And I think you saw that from the earliest days, and it made it very difficult for families like the McConville children just to work out what had happened to their mother, and for other families to figure out what had happened to their loved ones. And so, you know, it's not just that there's no accountability, that nobody ends up getting tried and sentenced for these types of crimes. It's that in many instances, people don't even know just the basic elements of what went on and who was responsible. And so you had that culture of silence, and I think to some extent that culture of silence continues in Northern Ireland today. So part of what I was trying to do with the book was go in as an outsider and see what I could find out and see if I could account for some of these facts as best I could.
You're listening to Patrick Radin Keefe. He is the author of Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. Did the Belfast Project help you along that way?
It didn't. I mean, it's certainly an interesting part of the story. So as I mentioned, the Troubles ended in 1998 with this landmark peace agreement, the Good Friday Agreement. But one of the tricky things about the Good Friday Agreement was that you had all these different parties. People might remember, you know, this was Bill Clinton was involved in this, and Senator George Mitchell and Tony Blair. And you had all these different parties who were kind of brought to the table, and they hammer out a peace agreement. But one of the oddities of that agreement was that there was no provision in it for how you should deal with the past. There was no Truth and Reconciliation Commission like you had in South Africa. There was no agreement over, you know, who are we going to hold accountable? Who can you charge with historical crimes? Who do we investigate? They didn't deal with any of that, I think, in part because if that stuff had been on the table, you never would have had an agreement. There never would have been a peace deal. So instead, they just kind of punted on the past and how to deal with it. And the agreement, the peace agreement, was just purely forward-looking. What that left was a vacuum, though, where there was no real mechanism for figuring out what had happened and how to deal with it. And so Boston College, which is a Catholic university with long historic ties to Ireland, set up a secret project to document the Troubles, a secret oral history project in which you would get people who had fought on the front lines of the conflict, and they would come in and tell their stories in great detail. And of course, this was a risky thing to do in a situation in which, you know, there was no amnesty provision. You know, nothing said that they couldn't be prosecuted for these old crimes. So what they did was they said, we'll make you a deal. If you come in and tell your stories, we'll seal them up, and we won't release them until you die. And this was another thing I found out about in that obituary, is that that woman, Dolores Price, had been one of the people who participated, who gave one of these interviews. And part of what my book is about is that, you know, that project that I just described and that deal that they made with people, you know, will seal up these interviews and nobody will know until after you're dead. That turned out to be a promise that Boston College wasn't really able to make. And so it all unraveled in a pretty spectacular way.
So there's a quote toward the end of your book that leads me to a question. And the quote is, "Who should be held accountable for a shared history of violence?" And then you quote Peter Corrigan, the Belfast lawyer, who said, "Why is everybody not being treated equally for conflict-related offenses?" Referring, of course, to the British soldiers who shot unarmed citizens on Bloody Sunday. We haven't had a chance to touch on that. But the question I have relates to the fact that one in four IRA members were informants for the British. They were double agents. And I wonder, as a way of showing what I think you allude to as British complicity in some of these IRA killings, you could relate the story of former Prime Minister Thatcher, who I think in some way was asked to draw the line. Help us understand this, because this is probably the biggest surprise for me in the book, that this wasn't as simple as black versus white.
Yeah, not at all. Not at all. You know, my book is a book about terrorism, and it's about paramilitary groups committing acts of violence in the name of a cause, but without state sanction. At the same time, you know, the flip side of that is about how do governments respond to terrorism. And I think a lot of the time you see overreaction, and in many instances you see governments doing things that, while the government is ostensibly legitimate and has a monopoly on the legitimate use of force, they do some pretty barbaric things. So in the context of the Troubles, the conflict pretty quickly became kind of a spy game in which a big part of the strategy of the British was, we want to penetrate the IRA and other terrorist groups. We want to get people inside. We want to turn them and, you know, basically create double agents. And so we can figure out what they're doing and get them to secretly work for us. And as you say, by the end of the Troubles, by some estimates, they were so good at that, that one out of every four people in the IRA was actually also working for the British. The interesting question that came up was, with the IRA or with these loyalist terrorist groups, the members of these groups are committing violent acts. So what does it mean if the state has somebody who's basically acting as their agent and is going out and murdering people, and they know about it? You know, from the point of view of the state, which is trying to cultivate spies inside the ranks of these groups, it's good, right? It helps you. You want to have somebody who's close to the action. But there's a real question, a legal question, and I think a moral question, about, you know, what does it mean when the state says, all right, well, we've got this guy and he's in this group and we're secretly paying him and he's debriefing and giving us information and he's going out and killing one person after another. At what point does the state become responsible in some measure for that person? And Margaret Thatcher was actually asked about this because a guy that I interviewed, who was one of the top police officers in Belfast who worked for Special Branch, kind of the intelligence branch of the cops in Belfast, he was running these agents, and the agents were doing terrible things, and he asked for guidance. He said, listen, I need to know, like, where are the lines? Where do you draw them? And the word came back to him from Thatcher, basically, look, it's better if we don't tell you. You know, you guys figure it out on your own, but keep doing what you're doing. And so you end up in a situation today in which there are a whole lot of lawsuits now brewing in Northern Ireland over what they call collusion. And the idea is that the British state ended up colluding in one manner or another with a lot of these paramilitary groups and should potentially be held legally responsible.
So you mentioned Dolores Price. There's a number of key characters in the IRA that get a lot of time in your book. But the one that I want to mention, because it may be the one name that people do remember from the days of the Troubles, and that's Jerry Adams. He seems to be a guy who led two lives. Could you tell us a little bit about, again, just sum up for us? His first life is pretty obvious. He's the IRA leader, and you can address that as you like. And then, of course, his more official or legal life.
Yeah, Jerry Adams is a big character in the book and a guy who I think is very enigmatic and fascinating. He joined the IRA as a young man, and he was very, very smart, very ambitious, very sophisticated, and quickly rose through the ranks of the IRA. One of the interesting things about Jerry Adams is if he were here with us doing this interview, he would say, no, actually, let me correct the record. I was never in the IRA. That's all just a misunderstanding. At a certain point, Adams started telling people, this is around the early 1980s, that he'd never been in the IRA, that actually he was just a political figure who played a role in Sinn Féin, which is like the political wing of the IRA. And what Adams started doing was encouraging a kind of a two-pronged approach. It became known as the Armalite, which is a kind of an assault rifle, the Armalite and the ballot box. We're going to have these two approaches. The Armalite will be the sort of hard-driving paramilitary war that the IRA was bringing. And the ballot box is an electoral strategy in which Sinn Féin, this Republican political group, ends up running candidates. And one of those candidates is Jerry Adams. And so Adams has this kind of interesting twin role where he's both a paramilitary but also increasingly a political figure. And in his political role, he denies that he was ever a paramilitary to begin with. And he becomes really essential to negotiating the peace agreement in 1998, to bringing the IRA to the table and getting them to accept, getting these hardened soldiers to accept the idea of a peace deal. The thing that was tricky about it is that in doing so, and in denying that he'd ever been in the IRA himself, he seemed to disown some of the people who had worked for him and taken his orders. And one of those people was that woman, Dolores Price, whose obituary started this story and who's a major figure in Say Nothing. And imagine for a moment that you have a role as somebody who's carrying a gun in a military organization, and you've promised to obey all orders, and you're given orders to do some terrible things. And you do them. And later in life, you have PTSD, you've got trauma, you're thinking about those awful things you did in your youth. And that was Dolores Price. She was really struggling with the things she'd done. And as she's struggling with them, Jerry Adams, who was the guy who gave her the orders, is saying, oh, well, I personally don't have any blood on my hands because I was never in the IRA. And so part of what the book is about is these two people who had a very close relationship in the early 1970s end up clashing in a pretty extreme way in more recent years because Dolores Price was sort of wrestling with things she'd done in her youth, and she's very angry about them. And she blames Jerry Adams, who was the guy who gave her the orders, and he says, I didn't give you the orders. I was never in the IRA.
That's quite a story. Well, we've run out of time, Patrick, but I want to remind our listeners that this book, Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland, has just been released in paperback. And I will also remind our listeners that you will be in Idaho this summer, where you will be attending the Sun Valley Writers Conference. We look forward to meeting you there. But most importantly, thanks for writing this. This is an incredible account. There's so many things on my long list of questions we didn't get to, and I knew that's how it would turn out. But the good news is our readers can pick up a copy of this book and read it in detail. Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland by Patrick Radin Keefe. Patrick, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Oh, thank you so much.
Next week, my guest is CNN national security analyst and best-selling author Peter Bergen to talk about his book, Trump and His Generals, The Cost of Chaos. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.